This is Creepy and Geeky, a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Welcome to Creepy and Geeky. I'm your host, Robert, and on today's episode, it's part two of my Chucky series, and we're talking about Child's Play 2 and 3. Joining me for this episode is Nat Bremmer. Nat is the author of Puppet Master Complete, A Franchise History, and a writer on Puppet Master the Game. Welcome to the show, Nat.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. Somebody who's intimately involved in movies involving toys, seemed like a good choice of having you on. So
yeah, well, these are I go back to childhood with this franchise, absolutely. When I was a kid, being raised in in the horror aisle of the video store, Child's Play 1, 2, and 3 were the movies I could not look at. I had to turn the tapes over.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To browse, because I could not look at the cover art. And it got so bad that my dad bought me Child's Play on VHS and was like, nothing going on in your head is, everything in your head is got to be way scarier than what the movie actually is. So just watch it. And that's what kicked off my obsession.
Oh, okay. All right. That's so funny. Would you say this was, Were these before the Puppet Master movies for you?
They were almost right around the same time. Because It's like I was watching horror movies, and that was what made it so ridiculous. For my dad, I was allowed to rent 80s horror movies. So he didn't understand why these ones? That's funny. Yeah, so it was they were pretty close together. Oh. So I was both a huge Puppet Master kid, was my number one obsession, but I was a huge Chucky kid, partially because it was the 90s and we all were.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what's interesting though, too, is Chucky, because he came out, the first Child's Play came out in 88, he's considered as an 80s franchise, but realistically 2, 3 and Bride of Chucky, at least 3 out of the 7 movies came out in the 90s, so a big chunk of that happened. Arguably some of the biggest ones. Definitely. That's cool. Were these how old were you when you got into horror movies? What age were you when you started watching these?
Horror in general goes back all the way, and so in that so much of it was marketed to, so much monster themed stuff was marketed to children, right, in the 90s. So I had that it was this big orange Frankenstein thing.
Yeah.
It was a play school thing where you pull them apart and see how it works. And I had Monster Face, which was a nightmarish Mr. Potato Head thing. And I remember being really into the Universal Monsters, and my dad got me those, and then I was bragging about those, and it was first grade. I met one of my childhood best friends, and I was like, oh, Dracula and Frankenstein. I was like, yeah, but what about Freddy and Jason? I was like, who? And it opened up a whole new world. So my first real horror movie I go back to was my very first sleepover. We rented the original Friday the 13th, and that kicked it off.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, no, I think that's what's interesting too, because the 80s were this, I like to say this renaissance of horror, I think mostly just because of the video boom. Mm-hmm. And so you had this huge amount of material that came out. And so those of us who grew up in the 80s, you know, by the time we were in the 90s, we were, you know, young adults, you know, moving out of that childhood phase. And so I remember, you know, because I turned 18 in 1992. So most of my 90s were as an adult. Mm-hmm. And so I had already moved past a lot of that stuff. But I could see it in the popular culture, the shifting of, like, there definitely was this huge shift towards horror for kids. Mm-hmm. Goosebumps, you know, anything by any, all of those books that came out around that time, the kind of like preteen, early teen horror type stuff. Yeah. You had all those making bug like gelatin things, toys, mm-hmm. and stuff. You had lots of toys and lots of things that were geared towards kids. And so it definitely was an interesting time for myself to kind of be outside of that, because I'd already, you know, I was already an adult and I was already watching, you know, bigger horror things when I did watch horror at the time. And so it's interesting to look back and remember just how weirdly that they were marketing horror to kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Chucky would be a big part of that in a lot of ways. They didn't sanitize these child play movies at all. So that's what's interesting too, is that both of these were hard R-rated movies, lots of violence, lots of language. You can't deny that probably a lot of kids were attracted to that, because it was a toy. It was a talking doll that came to life and was killing people and everything. So it made a kind of sense that the 90s kids would be attracted to that, and would, you know, that would be a huge franchise for them. So
yeah, I think that was key for both Puppet Master and Child's Play for me, and that I was a huge toy kid. I had a ton of toys. And I think the other thing with the Child's Play movies is that they had a child protagonist.
Yeah, I think that's because the Puppet Master franchise is also largely a 90s franchise as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is interesting that there was a whole bunch of stuff like that around that time. These movies, these Child's Play movies, these first three anyway, they revolve around that whole Chucky trying to kill Andy, or trying to put his soul into Andy, depending on the movie. It's interesting. You get a child protagonist that continued on too. And that was a cool thing that they did with these movies. I came to these movies much later. I'm pretty sure I saw the first one probably sometime around the time it came to video, or a little bit later, but I don't remember having seen two and three until just a few years ago.
Mm.
And I do remember seeing Bride of Chucky sometime after that came out, and Seed of Chucky right when that came out on video. I'll have a story for that in my next episode, which will be fun and interesting.
That's a whole tangent, because I missed Seed in theaters. That movie took like over a year to hit video.
Yeah. No, and that was, I didn't see it in theaters. I haven't seen any of these in theaters. But it's, and I saw, you know, most of them largely a while after they had come out. Mm-hmm. The only one that I saw even remotely close to when it came out on video was Seed of Chucky, which, like you said, came out like quite a while after it came out to theaters. But yeah, it's these two and three, they deal with Andy Barclay. This one, going into Child's Play 2, it's kind of almost directly following the events of the first movie. He's now in a foster home, or at the beginning of the movie, he's kind of in in a group home. Mm-hmm. And then he's going to be put in a foster home. And I think it's great too, because it doesn't get mentioned enough that I've seen when people talk about Child's Play 2, because everybody talks about Christina Lee, and, you know, it's great because she's she's back with the franchise and the Chucky TV series and everything. But it doesn't get talked enough about how the foster parents in this are kind of horror, not royalty, but horror. They've been in the horror realms quite a bit as well. Both Garrett Graham, who played, he's in Phantom of the Paradise. He was in Terror Vision. He was in Chud 2.
He was Bud the Chud.
Yeah, he was Bud the Chud. So, you know, it's interesting to see him, like, as soon as I saw him pop up on the screen. Now, when I watched it a few years ago, I didn't know who he was. But since then, I've seen at least Terror Vision and Phantom of the Paradise. I have yet to see Chud 2, but I will. But seeing him on screen, I was like, hey, it's that guy. But the mom in this is Jenny Agutter from American Werewolf in London. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw, I think, American Werewolf in London for the first time well after I saw this movie. So it was kind of reverse engineering in my brain for me.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's definitely interesting to see them. And then I guess Grace Zabriskie's in this as well. She's popped up here and there in horror and other genre fare. She plays the group home lady, mom, or whatever. This is an interesting movie because it like I said, it follows on after the events of the first one. Andy's mom is in like psychiatric care now. Because she's just deemed too, after everything, she's just deemed too crazy because nobody believes her story that that it was Chucky, which is a recurring theme throughout most of these movies. Nobody believes that a killer doll is actually doing all these killings.
Mm-hmm.
Andy's just having to adjust to this new family He gets Christina Lise as his foster sister, who, you know, kind of flipping the script on typical relationships at that time where, you know, all the kids would just be antagonistic towards each other. You know, they have a good relationship and, you know, they have a bond, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The core of that movie is how that bond builds, because she doesn't really want anything to do with him at the beginning. And I think part of what's so interesting about this movie is that Andy is kind of fighting like hell to stay in a foster home he didn't want to be in the first place, because it's still better than just being abandoned again.
Right.
Like, he just wants a family. This family isn't it, but Kyle is. And I think that's a surprisingly sweet core to the movie.
Right. Well, and I think that's, you know, because the family itself, the mother and father in this family, they try in the beginning, but like at the same time, it's like, there's a lot of things that they just kind of blame on the kids. Like and I get it, you know, your parent, you're going to blame the kids for doing stupid stuff, but, you know, damaging the little figure and everything. I was just like, okay, you guys need to calm down, back off just a little bit. Stop ripping into these kids. They said they didn't do it. Like, I get the kids lie, but come on. But I get it though, too. Like, again, this kid has issues and stuff, but it's like, for me, like, I guess looking at it from a more current perspective, when you watch movies like this and you just see how these parents and other people deal with these kids and other people just having such bad trauma that they're just like, okay, well, we're just going to give you this doll that was the deep seed of your, like, you know, problem here, but, you know, here, yeah, you can have this doll again. It's like,
yeah,
take the doll out and throw it away.
Yeah.
So,
and that's the thing, is like, they forgot that they had it because they've had so many kids come through.
Right.
And I think it's Joanne, like, initially is like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to get rid of this. Andy kind of takes the initiative. It's one of the most heartbreaking things in the movie to watch him be like, no, I can, you know, I can live with it. I can play with it, even though he hates this thing and doesn't know it's actually Chucky. But watching him go up to the doll and just be like, I hate you. And then parade it in front of them so that they can see him play with it. Because he's just heard them talking about, you know, having the kind of preliminary conversations about getting rid of him.
Right.
And I think
go ahead.
Well, I just think like the biggest issue with Phil and Joanne is that they needed to have a longer conversation about this. He heard like the first inkling of Andy's trauma and he was like, this is not for me. And he was in that being like, I don't know. And so like there, I think just the biggest issue with them as parents is they were never remotely on the same page about Andy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not only that, but they're not like they don't seem to like the mother does, but he doesn't seem to be coming from a good place of fostering these kids anyway. And plus, on top of that, if you're going to foster kids, put your shit away that is expensive and you don't want damaged. Because, you know, you're bringing in kids that, you know, have problems and, you know, are in a bad situation. One, accidents can happen. And two, these kids are going to be in bad, terrible moods that they're not going to have. And again, coming from a later perspective, you know, a more enlightened perspective that we have now in 2023 about that kind of stuff. Just it feels like when you watch something like this, it's like you guys put yourself in that situation. Mm-hmm. I know you think you're doing a good thing by taking these kids in, but you're not. Not if you're going to treat them like this, and not if you're going to have that attitude that you have. And it seems at least like the mom, she wants to do the right thing and she's trying. But, you know, they definitely need to have a more serious talk about together about what they're going to do going forward. I mean, obviously, it doesn't matter because they're both dead by the end of this movie. But but, you know, it's definitely something they should have talked about beforehand.
Yeah. And like she, I think that's one of the strongest beats of the movie, is that she comes to Andy's defense at every turn. And just the way she growls, get away from me, after Phil's death, when Andy kind of steps toward her because she is now sickened by the sight of this kid.
Yeah.
That's haunting.
Yeah. No, it's, it's, yeah, there's, and you can kind of understand it too. Like at that point, you're kind of like, okay, well, something about this kid is off, you know, because I mean, you're taking it from the perspective that they don't believe that the doll is real and killing people and everything. Yeah. So, you know, you just know, okay, there's been a whole bunch of murders around this kid. We tried to take him in. Now there's all this other stuff. Now my husband's dead. Yeah, I'd be a little bit like, whoa. Stay away from a kid, and all this kid needs is some love, man. Like that's what, like this kid is crying out for this love and everything. And thank God Kyle is there, you know, like the only sane person to help him and to be there and to believe him, you know. And that's what's great about this movie, is that bond, like we said, that bond that they form, and that you know, is still strong all these years later. You see later on in the Cult of Chucky and in the Chucky TV series, that they're still together. They're still, you know, a family of sorts.
Yeah.
And
she's still big sister. He's still little brother and everything. And it's great because like the lessons, the wisdom that Kyle's imparting on him is hard. It's genuine because it is just the way it is for the situation he's in. Like she's teaching him and telling him like how to be self-reliant, you know?
Yeah.
Because in the situation they're in, the world is going to let you down. You kind of have to take things as they come on your own.
Right. Yeah, no, she's like, as much as she's coming at it from like her own experience of having gone through all these foster homes and, you know, dealing with the things that she's had to deal with, And that's that, and that, you know, and that she has this hard exterior. She's obviously, you know, rough around the edges. She's smoking and all that, but she's the fact that she can still open up herself and to be there for him just says a lot about the character herself and about Christina Lisa's performance, bringing that to it and being mm-hmm. that big sister that he needed at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and pushing aside all that rough exterior, because he kind of wormed his way in. She didn't want him. She kept trying to push him away. She did everything she could to push him away, but he kept worming his way back to her. And she like, and he broke her defenses down. So.
And it happens pretty quick too. It's like after the first, you know, stuck doing chores together, it's just like she's walking into the bus and it's like she's the only one spending time with him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's literally the only one like that. And that's what's crazy to me. Like these parents, like you would think that, you know, you brought this kid in, you would, you know, of course, at least one of them's got to work or whatever. But you think the mom would want to try and spend some time with him, getting to know him, you know, but you never see the parents around. So it's just him and Kyle just like, you know, doing their thing. And
it's this huge house with all these rooms for all these kids, but there are only two kids here.
it just baffles me, like, the, you know, and I'm sure this was kind of what it was like at that time period for, you know, being foster parents and being foster kids and stuff like that. You had these parents who were just kind of in it for the money, because there is money to be made being a foster parent. And so you have those who are like that, who maybe one of them cares, but I mean, even still, the mom didn't care enough. And that's what always strikes me, is as much as she presented this front and she does seem to care at times, that there's a lot of times where she didn't care and mm-hmm. wasn't there for him and wasn't providing that maternal guidance and love that Andy so desperately needed at that moment. And that's what's frustrating watching this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, all that being said, you know, we come back to the big star of the movie, which is Chucky, really. We watch these movies for Chucky. This is, again, you know, most of these franchises we watch mostly for the villain. Most of these horror franchises, anyway, we watch to keep up with the villain, see what they're going to do next and everything. And this is what's interesting, too, is like, because whereas we get somebody like a Michael or Jason or something like that, and I guess I could equate Michael to Chucky in this way, where he's got a single-minded focus, at least in the first few movies, where he's just going after Laurie and then after Jamie. And so he's just, you know, not indiscriminate. He's not as indiscriminate as somebody like Jason is. Chucky's sole focus is in getting Andy. Mm-hmm. And anybody who gets in his way dies along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and Chucky has one of the greatest advantages ever, because he can pretend to be this inanimate doll or this doll with just like a voice chip and everything. It's so, that's what makes Chucky so good as a character, is that level of deception that he can do that no other slasher can.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, Child's Play was one of the first franchises to really embrace the fact that audiences were coming to watch the villain in a way that none of the others really had, by eventually just giving him more and more screen time, giving him from two to three more and more scenes by himself, and then four onward, literally making him the protagonist.
Right. I mean, they even changed the whole name of the franchise. You know, every movie from that point on features Chucky in the name. Mm-hmm. And because they're like, look, this guy's the star, you know? And so, and I think that they, you know, they tried to kind of, you know, balance it in these first three movies, but they realized, you know, probably after that point, let's really bump up Chucky. Let's really make him the star of the show in these movies.
Yeah. You know,
because he's obviously what people are coming to these movies for. So, But yeah, no, I think, and that's what's interesting is I think that, you know, something like Chucky was a product of Freddy in a way, because Freddy changed the slasher game in a lot of ways. Before we had these more silent killers, people who would, they wouldn't talk very much, and they would just, like I said before, kill indiscriminately. And then with Freddy, you had this wisecracking killer who came out of nowhere and had a personality. And that changed a lot of things. And I think that's what made Chucky so interesting. Following on that was that he took that and ran with it even more so. Like I said, he had that nice little deception ability to also pretend to be an actual doll and to throw people off, and really to make it seem like, even to this day, even into 2023, that in most of the movies and everything else, somebody else gets blamed for his murders. Like, nobody ever knows that he's the actual one killing. It's suspected. There's like rumors and stuff like that, but nobody really knows for sure. They're just like, oh, this kid, this doll shows up everywhere. There's always this doll showing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I find that fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah. It just becomes like an urban legend as it goes right on. That is a really interesting aspect. There are all these unsolved murders, and it's amazing that Andy even got away with being there, you know, by the time he's a teenager, by the time, like, he's been the one commonality.
Right.
With three separate of these incidents.
Yeah, that's what's funny about it is that, like, you know, when you look at it from like an outside perspective and stuff, you're like, there's something's wrong with this kid. We can't prove that it's this kid, but all these people keep dying around him. And really, somebody should be looking into this a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that was kind of the plot of the original. I think that's why they didn't
right.
get it as much in that.
Right.
By a certain point, they do kind of lock the kid away in the first one.
Yeah. And
so I like them not retreading the same ground.
No.
One of the things I love about Child's Play 2 coming off of the original is that it feels like, as much as I love the first one, it does introduce the clear dynamics between Andy and Chucky and, you know, give us Chucky as a character. But it feels like 2 was Don Mancini kind of taking the reins, even though he was just the screenwriter, from something right. that had been completely rewritten out from under him. And so yeah. like his original concept, the villain was really the toy company. And Chucky, the doll, was kind of wrong from the get-go. And it was targeting people that Andy had a subconscious kind of resentment towards. So right. the fact that you have this movie bookended by the doll factory and the huge doll factory finale, and you have the company involved, and you have Chucky specifically killing like the teacher and the foster father, those feel like all those elements that had kind of been stripped away from Mancini's original vision, that when he gets to come back and write the second one and kind of steer the franchise onward, he reintroduced a lot of those elements that were core to his original concept.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's when, because you look back on it and like you see that with 2 on, him and David Kirshner, who's his producing partner, in the entire franchise, they kind of got things back on track. Sure, he still had to let other people direct, but it feels like with 2 on, they were able to, outside of, you know, obviously studio interference, that they still got to keep everything pretty much as on track as they wanted to. And there's even something And even if he couldn't do it earlier, like in some of these other movies, there's something he wanted to do in number three that doesn't come into play until much later in the series. But, you know, at least then he's still kind of getting to steer the franchise the way he wants to. It's a lot. It makes it a lot more fun and interesting in a lot of ways. And the first Child's Play is great. It's one of the best of the franchise. Mm-hmm. But yeah, getting to see Mancini actually, you make these pull back in these aspects, like you said, is a lot of fun. Yeah, because the corporate aspect of it, watching the corporate guys, you know, get killed and everything is great. It's perfect in tone with everything, with everything that was going on. Just, and it just is so good because the corporate guys are just like, yeah, we don't have any responsibility for any of this. Uh-huh. Which, I mean, to be fair, they kind of don't.
They actually have nothing to do with them.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what's funny about it all. It's just like, you know, they really don't have anything to do with it. So, you know, but it's, you know, from a corporate perspective and everything like that, they're doing everything they can to make sure they don't have anything to do with it. So,
yeah,
because ultimately they don't even know that they don't have that, you know,
exactly. It's such a weird position because, you know, in horror, taking these supernatural things and putting them, it's one of the most fun things, putting them in a believable world and believable context. The fact that somebody may have programmed the doll to say those things and tampered with the voice box is the only believable explanation for what happened.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's what's interesting about it is, yes, they absolutely had no responsibility in any of this, but they kind of think they do anyway, and they still do everything in their power to make sure they end up with no responsibility and no culpability for it. So it's like, you know, even though they ultimately really didn't have anything to do with it, they kind of still made things worse. So mostly because they recreated the damn doll in the first place. So
it's like the ultimate PR move to be like, look, we built it back together and we can take you all through it to show that it works just fine. And then that's when they get that responsibility, like Mancini made sure to give them that responsibility in the first scene by having this test already kill somebody and have to be like, well, nobody finds out about this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. And again, of course, you know, with the corporate people being like, okay, well, this guy's dead. We're going to make sure nobody finds out about this and blah, blah, blah. And it's just, yeah, it's great that he tied that back in a way that does make them responsible in that way. And, you know, and then bringing it back to the end of the movie too, is having it there in the doll making factory was like so good. It's like such a great, not only is it a great visual feast in a lot of ways, because you don't see stuff like that in a lot of these movies. You don't see a lot of they usually put them in, you know, warehouses or, you know, something where it's like just visually not very interesting. So again, putting it in something like this toy factory where you have all this big machinery and you have all these stacks of good guy dolls and everything, is just, it's, there's so much going on. And it's great for him too, for Chucky, because he can hide, he can play with them. And that's what makes Chucky so much fun, is that this character that can hide and pretend and do all this stuff that a normal slasher just can't do.
Yeah. And like, it's, so much has been said about the whole third act and the doll factory. I think it works for a couple different reasons. I mean, one is that I think it's just such a nice symmetry to the movie to open and close in the doll factory. Right. It's like such a great structure, especially because we start the movie with Chucky being assembled in the factory, and we literally end the movie with Chucky being disassembled in the factory, and then he loses his hand, and then he loses his legs, and eventually melts down and his head blows up. And it's really gradual. It's in increments. But there's also the fact of, like, in that third act, Chucky is so the third that finale, there's such a chase building up to it, and there's such a sense of urgency getting up to it, and then it's when that finale starts, the movie actually slows down,
right?
And it takes a breather and it gets still, and that allows it to like build back up and go wild. And like, I think the ultimate key to it, though, is that it ends, or is that whole scene, that whole sequence begins with Chucky winning, begins with Chucky getting what he wants, and it doesn't work. So, because the voodoo angle was never Mancini's idea, I think that also takes it back to kind of him taking the reins, because it breaks free from the voodoo thing. It's there's such a structural thing to the ritual of, oh, if Chucky gets his hands on Andy, we have X amount of time to stop him. And right. Now it's like, if he gets his hand on this kid is screwed.
Yeah. No, and I think that's interesting, though, too. That because he took that back and he kind of neutered that aspect of it, but then he goes back into it in the later installments.
Yeah.
Which I find fascinating that, he goes back to that idea, but he uses it in his own more interesting ways. So, yeah. And I love that, that he takes that back in a lot of ways. So, but yeah. I agree that that whole sequence is, he's, especially once he gets to Andy, he tries to do it to Andy and it doesn't work. He's been in the body too long. And now he can't switch his soul.
Mm-hmm.
Which is in so many ways, it makes things so much better. It's, it keeps him in the Chucky body, because nobody wants to see him get out. Nobody wants to see him take over, and it makes him more dangerous now. Like you said, now Andy is screwed. There's no way Andy gets out of this alive if Chucky gets to him. Before, at least he had a chance, but now if Chucky gets to him, he's dead. So, and it just ups the tension so much more for the rest of the sequence, which again is just great, because now all the machinery's moving, all these, it's become a much more dangerous place for everybody involved, and it's a very enjoyable, fun last sequence of the movie.
Yeah, it's also kind of cool in that it kind of inverts the structure, like the size of the original, because the first movie is a lot bigger than people realize. Like, you have the whole shootout at the beginning, you have the toy store explosion, the house explosion, the car chase, and then the third act is kind of confined to the apartment. We're kind of around the house and around the neighborhood, and then we just go buck wild for the finale.
Yeah, and that's what makes it interesting when comparing the first two like that. Like, they do seem to pair very well together in those ways. Like you said, the contrastingness of them, and just if they had ended it with number two like they, that like they could have, it would have been a good duology just in and of itself. But I'm glad they continued it on, because we've gotten so much more interesting stuff since then. So I don't have anything else for number two, so we can jump into number three, unless you have something else to say about number two that we didn't mention.
I can't wait to get to three.
So number three. So number three literally came out a year afterward, but it's set about what, 8 years afterward?
Yeah, 9 months, and, I think, actually it came out.
Yeah. It came out less than a year after 9 months. That's crazy. Because I think they immediately went into filming the next one after they finished the first one, or after the second one. And this one's interesting because now obviously they couldn't use Alex Vincent as Andy this time. Mm-hmm. And this one still involves Andy. But they wanted to, you know, jump the timeline forward. So they ended up going with this actor named Justin Whalen, who looks a fair amount like Alex Vincent. So it wasn't.
It's pretty believable. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what's interesting to me is like he does a good job at being Andy and looking like Andy the whole time, that you never once, at least for me, I never once came out of it going, that's not the same kid. You know, he does a good enough job that, you know, he inhabits the character well.
Other smart thing was that time jump is the location, because like,
yeah,
anywhere else is going to look like 1991, but pretending to be 8 years later and kind of confining it to a military school where they all have uniforms. Yeah. And everything kind of always looks the same. And then a fair, which at the end, which has never changed in appearance. It was actually really smart locations for what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it worked really well, because I mean, you get these kids, other than the haircuts, I'll say this, other than the haircuts, because you get some early 90s haircuts going on in there, you know, especially Andy's is a little floofy there in the beginning.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, even his military cuts a little 90s-esque still.
Yeah,
and a little too fashionable for what I would assume the very straight laced military haircutter would have done, which was interesting too, because I didn't realize it at the time, but I found out later on that that's the guy from Hellraiser. From Hellraiser.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting little that I recognized him and I was like, who is that guy? But yeah, I think other than the haircuts, but because by the late 90s, because if you're thinking 98, which is when Bride of Chucky came out, haircuts and fashion had changed quite a bit since the early 90s. So at least keeping it within that confines of the military academy thing, yes, kept at least the dress, you know, in a state of timelessness. So that did help. That was a smart play on that, but it also gave them a unique way of changing things up. It gave Andy a different way to fight, because then he was able to use weapons and tactics, you know, what little he learned by that point, but gave Chucky a whole new crew of people to kill as well. So
yeah, and such interesting, such a clever dynamic to that whole thing. So Child's Play 3, I think now that Seed of Chucky has had its Halloween 3 moment, Child's Play 3 is viewed as the worst of the franchise by and large. And this is the movie I was so excited to talk about, because Child's Play 3 is my favorite Child's Play movie.
Okay.
It is my favorite of the series. I am one of its biggest defenders on this earth. And I adore this movie to death. And it's one of those movies where it's like, where most movies that I like that are unloved, I can be like, I can see what people don't love about this one. But this one, I'm so crazed for it. I'm just like, what aren't people getting about this?
I think that I like this one. I think that number 3 is good. I don't think it's great by any means, but I think that, you know, the reason why something like Seed of Chucky may have in when it first came out been unloved and then has now had that critical reappraisal is because of its campiness, and everybody can look back on it and go, look, they were actually having a lot of fun. Whereas I can see with number 3 where people can now look at that and go, I think the greatest sin that number 3 has, even though I like it, is that it's kind of bland at times. There's nothing really like super like you know, something like what Seed of Chucky or Bride of Chucky is, where they kind of reinvented everything, where Child's Play 3 is just kind of run of the mill in a lot of ways. So
it is in terms of being, in terms of stylistic and in terms of
right.
It like Seed, people can embrace now because it is such a, it's honestly such a John Waters movie to the point that it even has John Waters in it.
Right? It's so super camp. It's like the height of camp.
100%. I love it, but I get why people love it. But there are so many things that I think are genuinely so great going on in Child's Play 3 that I just feel the need to champion that one.
Yes.
So much more than the others. The biggest thing among them being that there is an undercurrent through the whole series of masculinity, of
yes,
presents masculinity while being in such an androgynous form. And it is an undercurrent for every other movie, but for Child's Play 3, it is the thesis statement. And the movie does so much with that. And I love it so much for that, because you have this environment that is one, just, and not that it's the first to do military school in a horror movie, but great because horror generally relies on unpreparedness, and that you have ideally people who are training for combat and for survival. But more than that, you have this environment where you are surrounded by this macho energy, by these manly men and doodly dudes. And you have our core cast of actual heroes who are anything but. And so you have a decorated, hard-ass colonel war veteran who takes one look at Chucky and promptly has a heart attack and dies. And then you have a character like Whitehurst, who is the cowardly lion of the movie, but who, despite being terrified in virtually every scene he's in some different kind of way, will see a grenade and jump on it to not only save his friends, but the people who have treated him like absolute crap.
Yeah.
And then kind of putting a bow on it, you have the most capable character in the movie by far being a girl.
Yeah. 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 No, I could definitely see that. Go ahead. Sorry.
And I just say, I love all those elements together and that running through the movie.
I think that's what's interesting. And then, you know, it's something that when you look at it from that perspective, and you look at and how we mentioned before that Mancini has had the chance to guide it from at least number two on, you see this undercurrent of this subversion of these tropes, mm-hmm. and everything that goes on, and you know, you get kind of to the top of that in Seed of Chucky, where you get this full-on campy queer movie that I think, you know, having somebody like Mancini, who is gay, be able to guide this franchise the way he wants is like fantastic.
Yeah.
And have those subversions, because even today, so I was rewatching the Chucky series, because I hadn't seen the second season yet, and the third season's just come out a couple of weeks ago, so I was going back, and while watching all these, I was also rewatching the first season of the Chucky series. And that series has a lot to do with that masculinity. You have these dads who are very like, played by Devon Sawa, who are very, both of these dads are very much like, oh, you guys got to be a man. You guys, you know, all this, this masculinity trope that's going on there. And Chucky's doing that same thing in this series that he's doing in this movie, is where he's like, you know, I'm teaching you how to be a man more so than your dad could be, like with the whole junior thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to go back and kind of parallel that to that, that that's something that Chucky continues to do throughout the series. throughout the franchise itself, because it's not the only time he does that. So, yeah. Because it's a major plot point in Seed of Chucky as well. So,
and I think the subversiveness of this one, and kind of pointing out those tropes and kind of, you know, poking at it like just under the surface, is a major stepping stone to the later entries getting to do things much more explicitly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're hitting that right on the head there too. It's just that, he was test running a lot of this as much as he could. He was putting in as much as he possibly could, putting in those little things here and there to continue that theme forward, hoping that he'd get a chance to really open it up later. And I'm glad he did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad, though, that looking back at this movie, that you can see that and you can appreciate that for what it is. And you're right, that does make it a more interesting movie on that level.
Yeah, I think one of the best examples of it having to do that is that in this movie, the particular bully, the particular hard ass on Andy's case, Shelton, he, like, it was, I guess he talked to, like, with Mancini, was the director, and he played that character as being closeted gay, which, you know, in a entry in the franchise at this point, that would obviously be a part of the plot. Like, that would be explicit. That would be something you see the character dealing with. But it's just, like, it's interesting that in 1991, they were like, oh, we're going to play it like this, but obviously we can't say it. And it's so cool to see that, like, now you absolutely could. Now it would be a major aspect of the show and be so interesting to deal with. But, like, so again, it just shows how gradual that's been able to evolve through the films. That we had one earlier on, they were like, oh yeah, we played it like this way, but we couldn't say it, where now you very much could.
Right. And I felt like that's kind of how Andrew Robinson was playing his character as well. The character comes off being a little too obsessed with these kids and their hair and everything. Mm-hmm. And there was a level of that was super creepy. Yeah. And so, and not in just the general, like, you know, overly masculine way and everything like that, that it came off. And I'm not saying that he was trying to portray like a predatory gay person, but just more of like a pedophile almost in a way. And so it just came off as really creepy in that way.
Yeah. And it's another one of those moments that's kind of subverting masculinity, because he's
exactly
just a hard ass. And to the point that he is a psycho, like, this man feels genuinely psychotic. Yeah. And then he has this moment where it's almost, in such a weird way, even though it's like the weirdest thing, it's almost the most harmless thing he does in the movie, which is that he's going to play with this doll when he makes sure nobody's looking.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an odd performance for sure. And it's like one of those things where it's like, I really like, I'll have to listen to the commentary at some point to see if they have anything to say about it. But it's just one of those things where it's like, I want to know more about, like, how much was in there that the direction was trying to go for, you know, how much the actors were just reading into that writing in the right ways. So, because I do think that that's something that Mancini may have put in the subtext of it all. So, but it's you know, and that's what I think is interesting about it, is not only has Mancini been able to guide this franchise through writing all of it and then eventually getting to direct it all, but David Kirschner as the producer, it's something I didn't realize until I started watching all these, was that, you know, he was there also along every step of the way, you know, he has just as much vested interest in this series as Mancini does. And yeah. So it's fascinating. And I ended up watching the documentary about, the making of all the movies and everything. And it was just great to kind of see them kind of get the chances to continue to guide the franchise along the way they wanted to, with whatever little hiccups, you know, through studio interference or whatever along the way. But for the most part, they've been able to do what they wanted to do.
Yeah. And it was a kind of a family affair, like, or two things. Yeah. It was a family affair. It was like you had Mancini and you had Kirshner and you also had Kevin Yeager driving all the effects. And then since then, we've had Tony Gardner.
Yeah. Yeah, that's again like the fact that they continue to kind of just have the same people come through. And the only reason, I guess, Kevin Yeager, from watching that documentary, the only reason why he didn't continue was because the studio didn't want to pay his money. Yeah. What he was worth for the franchise at that time, because, you know, obviously each one of the sequels got less and less money. But, yeah. You know, and then bringing Tony Gardner in, and then, you know, creating this, you know, secondary family with the effects crew and everything like that. And just seeing how everybody through each one of these has just been like, they just put their all into it. It was a really fun documentary to watch and just see the love that they pour into this homicidal doll.
And I get Yeager's probable surprise with what they offered him when you consider how cheap Seed of Chucky was compared to how much money Bride made.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that,
yeah, that,
that,
yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Key to that was getting so little money, even though Bride was such a huge success, and waiting until for Mancini to be like, you know, the more the budget got smaller, the more control he got, so that he could just make the movie he wanted to make and direct it himself. So it absolutely, the stars still aligned.
Yeah. And I think that's what's, and I think getting Tony Gardner in for these later installments was a huge get in a lot of ways too, because as much as losing Yeager wasn't great, you know, you don't want to lose a member of that family that had been a part of it up to that point and everything, but getting somebody else who could come in and give the same passion and attention in the later installments was like really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Tony Gardner is still a part of it, even into the TV show now. Mm-hmm. So definitely a big family affair. Which is cool. Like in so many ways, like getting to see people, because you don't get to see that, like the people who are guiding, you know, the other, you know, horror franchises by and large aren't the same people. You know, studios interfere and get a hold of things and they do what they want with it instead of, you know, the creators getting to actually have that creation maintained in their own hands the whole time. So it's cool to see something like Chucky get to continue through like that. So, and especially something like this, you know, and going back to number three, something that you can, you know, guide from, you know, add in these subversive messages and stuff like that to kind of guide it into this way that you want to, and you know, get to where it is now, is just fascinating for something that comes from Mancini, you know, like we said, who's gay man, this franchise that's like very queer in so many ways, and it was so many ways from the beginning as well, that, you know, I love that, you know, because horror is inherently queer, like people say, you know, there's so much of so much queerness in horror, and getting to see somebody who gets to guide that and gets to have one of the biggest franchises and gets to continue doing it is just, it's fantastic to me. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I love how much of it he put very intentionally into three. I love All the Ways 3 just keeps the same structure while also changing up the structure by putting, I think, honestly, even though it's great to see Alex Vincent play the character in every other thing, I love seeing Andy in that role reversal of having to, especially because so much of the movie is, as they say in the film, putting away childhood things. It's him putting his childhood to rest. It is getting to watch him mature and come into his own and protect, you know, protect somebody the way that his mother and Kyle protected him. And in that respect, it's no surprise he falls for a very strong woman.
Yeah, exactly.
De Silva has one of my favorite character introductions, honestly, maybe in any movie. I love just in that one scene, her repeated emasculation of Shelton, starting by calling him an asshole. And then, because he gets all embarrassed, he starts to give this whole spiel to the girls specifically while he's making her do push-ups about how, you know, nobody gets any special treatment. And he starts faltering as she's doing the push-ups because she's doing them so capably that he then gets all like just dude-like and just starts, you know, gets all flustered and makes her do them one-handed. And then she does that just as easily as she did the others. And it's just completely and totally, like, it's such a great scene to introduce both of them because it sticks to you for the rest of the movie. It's like, she did that and she made him look like such a piece of shit doing that.
Right. Yeah. No, it's, there's some good characters in this, you know, they're stock, the stock bully characters and such. And, the nerdy friend who's really not, you know, there for, he doesn't really care about getting involved in all that stuff. But I think there was something I was going to say about it. I think it's interesting. I wanted to go back to the beginning because this is something I meant to mention earlier. But we see the recreation of Chucky again. Mm-hmm. After the events of number two, they peel him off the floor, and as they're pulling him across the warehouse, the factory or whatever like that, his blood drops into this vat of plastic, and that's obviously what reanimates him into another doll later on. But during this movie, this was what's funny is I did see. Pretty sure I saw Cult of Chucky before I saw number three. And so while I was watching number three, I was like, this is the perfect moment for them to make multiple Chuckies because that blood is going to be stretched across multiple dolls. It's not going to be just in one doll. And that was what I think was the original plan. That's what he was going to do. Because it's been said, since then that's what he wanted to do was back in number three. He wanted to make multiple Chucky dolls, but they couldn't do it because of the limitations at the time.
Yeah.
And, but he eventually got to do it in a different way. And so I'm happy he finally got to do it in a different way. Cause I love the whole aspect of multiple Chuckies. It just makes things so much more wild and crazy.
Yeah. Everything is the same. Like he said, there's so many ideas that were around even from just that original concept that he managed to use something of everything he had an idea for. He got to use in some way in a later movie or in the show. And I love that element to it.
Yeah.
Nothing can compete with the third act of two, but I love the third act of three, especially because I'm just such a big carnival horror person. Just the weird, creepy, no fair has a budget for this in the world dark ride that ends this movie is just, it just warms my soul. And it's a big part of why this is, I love talking about it this time of year, because this is a Halloween Day movie for me. Child's Play 3 goes out. It's largely because of that third act. I always try to watch that on Halloween Day or night if I can.
It's funny. Yeah, no, it's great. Like, you know, we get the sequence just before that because they all go on their war game. And Chucky does this ingenious for a killer thing, and he replaces all the blanks, all the paint pellets that they're actually supposed to be shooting at each other with actual bullets. Mm-hmm. And so these kids end up killing each other. And instead of him having to do all the work, and it's just nuts. It's a great sequence. Cause you just, these kids are just like, yeah, we're going to get them. And then they realize about halfway in that these kids are dying that they're shooting at, and they have to, you know, get them all to stop shooting and everything. And just like, there's bodies littered all over the place. And you mentioned it before too, like the one kid has to jump on a grenade to save everybody else. And it's the kid, like we said before, that was the least likely to do it. He wasn't very heroic or wasn't into all of this at all. But you know, to save his friends, he jumps on the grenade and saves everybody.
And the thing I love most about that whole scene is that there's no real reason for Chucky to do it other than the love of doing it.
Yeah.
And it shows, goes back to like how they just let him go loose and just try to kill Andy at the end of two, is that they keep allowed themselves to put in more scenes of just Chucky being Chucky, because this is who he was before. And this is what he loves to do. So just to watch him revel in the absolute large scale chaos of this is fantastic.
Yeah. I love when Chucky just gets unhinged. Like, it's just, you know, he just goes all out psycho. Because it's so much fun. Just, you know, when he doesn't have to hide himself anymore. And he just goes after somebody. It's just, it's the greatest. And getting to see him just kind of revel in everything is great. So, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I will admit, going back to thinking about like the big finale and knowing all the criticisms it's gotten over the years, I will admit that narratively, yes, the fair does come out of nowhere. But I think that thematically, it works perfectly, because with so much of Andy's arc being about kind of putting a bow in his childhood and moving on
from
childhood, it is such a fair, and the whole carnival aspect is such a great setting for that, and such a great place for that, and to have that whole scene revolve around. And even with it being in a big carnival funhouse dark ride, because it's kind of childish and it's kind of horrific, because that's what Andy's childhood was. His childhood was a nightmare, and so it feels very representative of that.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, when you look at it from that perspective of, you know, these movies are about this loss of innocence and this loss of his childhood. And even at this point where he has to grow up and he's protecting this other kid who's in this same position that he once was, you know, the fair in that way kind of represents that last vestige of childhood for him. It's this last place where, you know, the other kid, he's like fascinated. Oh, that's fair. This is cool. You know, but, you know, but for him and for other kids, you know, that'd be a great thing. But in this moment, you know, it's once again, Chucky taking this childhood aspect and destroying it, ruining it for, you know, for anybody involved, this other kid, and for Andy himself, and you know, And like the Dark Ride itself, you know, the Dark Ride has all this sinister, macabre stuff going on, a lot more so than, like you said, the typical Dark Ride that one of these fairs might have, which are, you know, a lot less ambitious. This one is very ambitious. This one's almost on a Disney level of what's going on inside of it.
No local fair has the budget for that. It ruined those kind of rides for me as a kid because they did not look like that. And that was what I was getting every time. But yeah, it's such a great thing for Andy because it's not just about, you know, he's not just taking Chucky out to save Tyler from having his soul taken over. He's trying to save this kid from having the childhood that he had. And that's ultimately what he wins, is he even though he maybe gets arrested at the end, he does succeed in that.
Right. That, you know, and it is interesting to have that aspect of it because, you know, we don't know what happens to Andy after that point. We don't see Andy again until, you know, the end of Curse of Chucky. And at that point, he's a full-on adult who's been around for a while and everything, and obviously is mostly okay. But, you know, after that point, after this point, we don't know what happens to him. We just hope he has a happy life after that point. But there's no happy life for this kid. I mean, all the stuff that he's been through. And that's what makes it a little interesting, too, is that we don't get much we don't get very many details about the 8 years of his life between Child's Play 2 and Child's Play 3 either. You know, just that he was in a series of foster homes.
And that's where I think it does kind of fit just the structure of the movie and what the movie by itself set up, and that all we know is that he's been bounced around from foster home to foster home. He was kind of afraid of in two. And so for him to just end that with don't worry, you know, I've been here before, it's kind of heartbreaking because he's being kind of delivered right back into the place he was at the start of the movie.
Right. It's that's the frustrating, that's the only frustrating thing I find with it, is just the lack of, and I know they got to jump into the movie and not give you too much, you know, to bog you down in exposition and everything like that. But it was like, I would like to know a little bit more about what's been going on. Why, what's going on with his mom? Why can't he be with his mom? Is she still in the mental hospital? Like, you know, is like, there may have been a background thing that they mentioned or something seen in there. I just don't remember it at the moment, but
there is, I believe, one line saying that she's still
under something,
which is horrific.
Right? Like, what? Like, are they blaming her for the murders? Is that, because that's the only reason why I could see why she would still be under psychiatric care. This many years later, like, what happened to her that she needed to be in that? Because by the time we see Andy in Curse of Chucky, he talks to his mom on the phone and she seems to be okay at that point, you know, based on the limited conversation they have.
The one thing I take issue with that amazing comeback scene in Curse of Chucky that warmed my heart so much is that he's talking to her on the phone and it implies that she and the detective from the original wound up together. And he's like, say hi to Detective Norris. And like, okay, but in Child's Play 2, the reason given in that movie that she went under psychiatric care is because she backed up the story and he didn't. So do not get together with that man. You can do better, Karen.
Absolutely. And especially if she's still in psychiatric care by Child's Play 3. I mean, that's just what? Like, what happened? Like, did he just continually go back and testify against her? Like, what? Like, that's just cruel. So, oh man. But yeah, no, but I like these two movies. I think that, you know, this franchise as a whole has so much more going on. It's so many layers that are going on to it that, you know, like you said, with Child's Play 3, that it could, you could see from people, you know, having that critical reappraisal seed of Chucky, that number 3 could become the worst of the franchise. But I still don't think so. I don't think there's a really bad one in any of these. I think they all have their own charms, and I like them all, some more than others. But
if this is your worst made of the series, you have a great series.
Yeah, exactly. No, I would say Chucky as a series has kind of gone up for me. Like I used to, I didn't ever not like it, but I hadn't watched very many of them. And so coming, I watched it a few years ago. I watched the whole series a few years ago and really enjoyed it. And then going back through this again, I've really enjoyed it a lot more this time. And just the level of consistency through everything. They don't have to backtrack and tell you a lot of, you know, backstory to fill in holes or whatever like that. They just continue through in every one of them. Even Seed of Chucky, as wild and wacky as that is, it still fits. And that's what's great about the Chucky series, is you can make a weird movie and it still makes sense, it still fits, everything works. It, you know, may not be your taste, but it still works and doesn't detract anything from any of the other movies. Yeah. So
it's the clearest argument for letting one creative voice kind of dictate the franchise, letting the same writer write everyone and then eventually direct and steer the ship for the whole series, is that you, when you do that, you get people who don't want to repeat themselves and never want to make the same movie twice. So it becomes kind of consistently refreshing.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's what, you know, that's what happens with, and you let them breathe. You let them have time between installments. You know, obviously 1, 2, and 3 came fairly back to back with each other, especially 2 and 3. But, you know, once they started letting them breathe a little bit and giving them time to come up with stuff and to make them interesting and have a lot of fun with them, you're not beholden to that dollar. And you can make things that are more interesting, more fun, and you're not trying to just pump something out. And I think that's always the problem with a lot of these horror franchises that just want to pump out. And, you know, I say that, but I think the Saw franchise, which I just did a series on the podcast, I think they did okay with what they did, even though they were kind of making it up as they went along each time. They made it work, thankfully. Their consistency overall is mostly good. Maybe not as good as the Chucky series is, but I think Chucky does it right in a lot of ways. And the fact that he's managed to get a TV series that's now on its 3rd season and still getting a lot of people talking about it in its 3rd season is huge. So I love that.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention about number 3 that we did not talk about?
I think we did it justice. I think I made the love of this movie clear. And yes. Glad.
Good. All right. Well, why don't you let people know where they can find you online?
You can find me on the site formerly known as Twitter.
We still call it Twitter here.
At Nat Bremer. That's primarily where I am. I think I'm at Nat Bremer on everything. So like Instagram at Nat Bremer, Blue Sky, I want to believe, at Nat Bremer, but Twitter is primarily where I am. And you can get my book, Puppet Master Complete, wherever.
Definitely check that out. And also check out the audiobook version. If you haven't done that either, the music in that is done by Jerry Smith, who is the composer of my theme song here as well.
Yeah, and just crazy, even though I knew Jerry and Jerry was a friend, it was still crazy for me to have a composer of a Puppet Master movie.
Yeah.
That's cool. the audiobook. They did a great job with that. That was awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely go check that out. It's a lot of fun. I still need to read it myself. I'm going to get the audiobook version for sure. And check that out. I do have a Puppet Master series planned for next year, and that you will definitely be tapped to come back on if you'd like to.
Happily.
All right. Well, thanks again. I appreciate you coming on.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Nat for joining me. On Friday, Violet Hammond returns to the show to talk Avengers Infinity War. And on Monday, Angel Cross returns to the show to talk about Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky. Thanks for listening. Creepy and Geeky is a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Please check out morbidlybeautiful.com/podcasts for more great shows. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving the show 5 stars and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, please share the podcast on social media to help spread the word. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or at creepyandgeeky.com. Music for the podcast is Gratitude, composed by Jerry Smith. You can follow the podcast on social media at Creepy and Geeky on both Twitter and Instagram. If you'd like to follow me, I'm GeekThulu on Twitter and Blue Sky, and Geek.Thulu on Instagram. You can support the podcast by ordering teas and more on TeePublic or by donating to the coffee page. All of the links are in the show notes. Finally, don't forget, stay creepy.